Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and this week's online video picks are up on our website. Each week we select 5 web videos, and I anchor them on our site in a picks video. One video this week is of a college student asking President Obama a question at an economy town hall about legalizing drugs and prostitution for economic growth. The president was a little startled, and you'll see his response. See all 5 of our weekly video picks at WNYC.org/video. And now that report from Stove Camp. What do we mean, Stove Camp? Well, you probably take your electric or gas stove very much for granted, but half of the world's population, that's about 3 billion people, still burn wood, dung, coal, or other solid fuels for cooking. And not coincidentally, in many countries, smoke inhalation is the 6th leading cause of death. Burns are among the most common injuries, and those countries are the poorest in the world. Well, it turns out there is a fanatical world of stove makers that is on the case to create the stove that could literally save millions of lives and help curb climate change. This is a good Copenhagen-related conversation, too. New Yorker staff writer Burkhard Bilger spent some time with these engineers and wrote a piece on it called Hearth Surgery, which appears in the current issue of the New Yorker, and he joins me now. Burkhard, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
How do these 3 billion people cook? Explain the distinction between cooking with a stove at all and the alternative.
Well, one of the difficulties of the whole problem of making this stove is that they cook in lots of different ways. I mean, a fair number of them cook over open fires, what they'll call a 3-stone fire, where you just have 3 big rocks on the ground and you put wood over it or any kind of solid fuel. Some of them use coal burners. Some of them use things that burn grass clippings. There's all kinds of different ways to do it. And, of course, you're talking about 3 billion people. There's thousands of different dishes that have to be made on these different types of stoves, and they have their very specific ways of making them.
And the thing about the stove that we probably don't even think about very much is really the exhaust mechanism, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's how do you – you have 2 choices, basically. You either – burn the wood really cleanly, and so it's not producing much exhaust. It's just producing CO2, basically. Or you put it through a chimney and pipe it out of your house. But both of those things require a mechanism of some kind in your house.
So, like in this country, sometimes people get wood-burning stoves because they think it's kind of a back-to-nature thing in a way, or it's kind of quaint. But it's really no better for the environment than burning oil or gas.
No, I mean, actually, wood can be a wonderfully sustainable and eco-friendly material, partly because, you know, you're putting – if you burn it well in a good wood-burning stove that someone here might have in their house, you're burning it well, and really you're just putting CO2 in the air, and then that CO2 is being taken up again by the trees, and so it's kind of carbon neutral. So in a way, it's not a particularly dirty technology, but you have to – you know, those wood-burning stoves cost $1,000 or more, and we're talking $10.
So for the other half, the other 3 billion people in the world, problems associated with cooking without a stove include health effects like bronchitis, heart disease, low birth weight, cancers, cataracts, pneumonia, tuberculosis. Plus, indoor smoke kills 1.5 million people every year, according to the World Health Organization. Then there's carbon emissions and deforestation from this kind of cooking, which leads to global warming. Are they talking about stoves in Copenhagen right now, literally?
I wouldn't be surprised. It was part of the Waxman-Markey climate bill that the House passed in June. So it's something that's suddenly come into people's radar because these stoves produce a lot of soot, which is also called black carbon, which is hugely warming in the atmosphere. It's actually 600 times, up 680 times, I've heard, as warming the atmosphere as CO2 is.
And I gather there's something kind of ironic here, which is that people in the stove maker world say now that stoves are couched in the climate change debate, which is chic in its way, it's getting attention. But when it was just killing 1.5 million people a year, nobody cared.
Yeah. I mean, the problem was always they would go, you know, stove experts would go to funding agencies and say, look, this is a situation that's causing all these deaths. Why can't we have stove programs? And they'd say, well, you know, I'm going to have to spend $100 million. Can I spend that $100 million on a vaccine instead? Won't that get me a more efficacious result? And now suddenly stove people can say, well, yeah, you'll not only get health results, you'll get climate results, you'll get just lifestyle results. So it's kind of become a kind of a multi-effect development.
Burkhard Bilger, my guest on WNYC, who wrote for The New Yorker the piece this week called Hearth Surgery. And for this New Yorker piece, you went to something actually called Stove Camp with Peter Scott, who is a celebrity in the world of stove makers. Stove Camp is a week-long gathering at the Aprovecho Research Center. You call it a hippie Manhattan project. Uh-huh. What are they doing there?
Well, it's a gathering of about 30, 40 people who, I mean, it started out about 10 years ago as a pretty parochial affair. It was these kind of hobbyists almost, and people who had been involved in the stove world for a long time but had never gotten much money from development agencies. And now suddenly when I went, there were EPA folks there, there were NIH folks there, there were academics from all over the place. It has become kind of a pretty powerful little gathering of expertise.
And sorry, where is this exactly?
It's on a little island in Oregon, south of Eugene, called Fred's Island. It's owned by a retired carpenter, and everybody pitches their tents, and they have the stove lab set up in an old slaughterhouse and meatpacking facility. So it's kind of it's a really fun, ragged kind of scene, but there's some really high level work going on there.
Can you describe some of the stoves that these folks are designing? Do they resemble what we usually think of as a stove?
Well, you have to think of the limitations that they're working under. I mean, you know, in a lot of parts of Africa, I was told by stove project people, you know, people want a stove to cost less than a pack of cigarettes. It's not something that people can afford to spend a lot of money on, and the typical number is $10. So what can you – and that's actually the huge engineering problem. How do you build something that can last for 5 years, that is clean enough to burn in your house, that will not use a lot of wood, and that costs less than $10? And I had Peter Scott, the stove maker you mentioned, he did a project where he did some consulting with the guy who'd done the modeling for the Voyager 2 space probe. And that professor said, look, what you're trying to do is more difficult than modeling the Voyager 2 space probe. So it's really a tough engineering problem. And the stoves that come out of it are interesting, and they don't look like much. They're these little – they look like a stock pot, maybe. They'll have a metal grate on top, a hole in front. You'll stick some wood into it, and you would think, oh, my God, it's simple. What's the big deal? But the truth is, over and over again, you'll compare two or three stoves of different designs, and it may just be a millimeter's difference here, a millimeter's difference there, but one uses 50% less wood than the other and produces 60% less emissions.
So the question, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we make a decent stove for the half the human beings in the developing world, actually applies here. And we have a caller, Kim in Carroll Gardens, who says she manages a nonprofit which advocates for more fuel-efficient stoves. Kim, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, I totally agree with your guest. We think that there should be a crash program for the global conversion to adopt these energy-efficient stoves, and also introduce other very simple technologies that are out there to improve, for example, the kilns that are used to convert wood to charcoal, and also promoting the use of alternative to wood and charcoal, sustainable biomass. For example, the folks at MIT, there's a design lab there, they're working in various parts around the world where they turn discarded agricultural waste into these little briquettes that burn cleaner, hotter, longer than traditional wood and charcoal.
And Kim, I'll have to leave it there, but I see your group, which is based in Brooklyn, is called the Charcoal Project, right? Charcoal
That's
Project,
correct.
If people want to look you up. So thank you for adding your voice. Does giving people a stove actually change their lives? And in addition to the engineering feat that this project has posed, is there also a cultural aversion to cooking in new ways?
Well, there's two problems. I mean, ideally and often it does work that you give them a great stove. I was in Guatemala in a really poor village, and we visited a number of families, and they had been given these plancha stoves that have a metal griddle. And those were well-designed stoves, and they made the house clean, you know, made the air clean, and they loved them. But you have two problems. One, the stove movement has a kind of a checkered history. I mean, it's been 30 years of trying to make these stoves with very little funding. Design failures, and that's the problem. I mean, back in the 70s, there was the dominant philosophy was appropriate technology, and they thought we need to work with local villagers who will show us how they cook, and we'll design everything exactly around their ways of cooking, which is a wonderful idea and still necessary. But if you stop there, you end up with lots of kind of jerry-built stoves, each of which is very different from the other. And if 1 millimeter can make a difference between an efficient stove and inefficient, it's just never going to work. I mean, there's kind of a trail of failed stoves around the world from the 70s up to the 90s.
And so as you report, USAID and the Gates Foundation and other funders want hard numbers in terms of exactly how many lives are saved.
They do. And then the second problem is, of course, okay, so you build a stove that is efficient, and let's say you mass produce it, which is more and more the wave now, and you know it's going to work. What happens when the people say, well, you know what, I kind of like the smoke, it kept away the mosquitoes? Or if the people say, you know what, it tips over when I use it, so I'm having trouble cooking on it? Or if it's just something that they don't recognize that it makes a difference health-wise, they may say, okay, it works, I like it, it's a perfectly good stove, but I'm not going to pay $5 for it because I don't really see that smoke as a problem. My grandmother, who's 90 years old, has been cooking over smoke for 10 years, and she's fine.
You mentioned the Waxman-Markey climate change bill that passed in the House this summer, which includes subsidies to address this issue. What's going to come of that?
Well, the Waxman-Markey doesn't yet include subsidies. It's saying we should go and identify funding or ways to produce 20 million stoves. And I think actually there's a huge amount of movement on this. I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase is already putting together carbon credit subsidies for stove programs in Africa. There's just been an announcement that India wants to do an enormous stove project to build 150 million stoves in the next 10 years. And that, if that happens, and there's a good chance it will, that could save up to 2 million lives. So there's a lot of movement. It's just a question of putting all these pieces together.
So what came out of your trip to Stove Camp?
Well, Peter Scott, the designer you mentioned, was working on an injera stove, which is a stove for Ethiopia where they make that wonderful spongy flatbread that you get in Ethiopian restaurants. That's the staple of Ethiopians. And it's just one of the most inefficient cooking practices in the world. People will be in these women's cooperatives. They'll have 50 stoves running, which are almost open fires. And they're producing an enormous amount of smoke and consuming huge amounts of firewood. I mean, Ethiopia has, I think, 3% of the forest it had originally left. So he was trying to create an injera stove that was efficient and workable. And through a lot of trial and error and failures and successes, he finally managed here in late November to make one.
Burkhard Bilger's article, Hearth Surgery, is in this week's edition of The New Yorker. Really interesting and so much more important than many people had realized before. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, and Paige Cowett produced this program. We had intern help today from Rachel Senator and Matthew Gurry. And our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. I'm Brian Lehrer.